My guest this morning is one of Australia's greatest musical successes. Rock and roll legend Jimmy Barnes has had an amazing life, albeit a life of hard drinking and hard living. It's a life too big and a story too extraordinary for just one book, so Jimmy's recorded it in a two-volume memoir. You'll remember last year's Working Class Boy talked about his upbringing and drinking, the violence, abuse that framed his adolescence. Well, the sequel, Working Class Man, is out, and it's an honest account of music, fame, and addiction. It is a confronting and at times hair-raising read. Jimmy Barnes, good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, you say in this book that you don't need to have read the first one, Working Class Boy, to get this one, but I think they go hand in hand because so much of your childhood informs us about the choices and what you do as an adult.
Well, yeah, you could sort of work it out, I reckon, you know, if I'm reading just the second one. But a lot of people see know me and don't know this about the childhood. They know me as a rock singer. But if you want to see a lot of the choices I made, you know, the way I behaved was formed really and molded by a childhood marred by, with, you know, violence and abuse and all sorts of stuff. I think they go hand in hand. Really, the first book is about that, the impact of that on a child, and then the second book is really about the impact of having a life like that has on a man as he grows up. And it doesn't matter whether you're a rock singer or a buddy or a mechanic. If you come from that sort of background, you know, you're going to have a lot of baggage and a lot of stuff to sort through as you grow up. And basically, I sort of sorted through my stuff and in the public eye, as you said. I lived it all, you know, on TV and on stage. And unfortunately, I can't hide from it. A lot of people seen the mistakes I was making.
And if we pick up, well, I at times felt like I was watching a Trainspotting movie. I mean, I sort of thought that I knew something about you, but I had no idea the depth of the drugs and the alcohol, the mushrooms, the heroin, the speed, the whiskey, the cocaine, the screaming. It was full on.
Yeah, no, that was just the first chapter. No, listen, you know, I mean, you got to remember that I did grow up, you know, where, you know, I probably had my first whiskey when I was, you know, two. You know, my dad used to give us whiskey at midnight on New Year. The first time I got really drunk was when I was 8 or 9, you know, 10, something like that. And it wasn't long till I was getting drunk regular. I took hard drugs when I was 12, you know. Mm-hmm. By the time I was 16 and in a rock and roll band, I was going crazy. I was in gangs fighting, taking LSD and speed and whatnot every night of the week, you know. So by the time the second book comes along, I was well and truly, you know, out of control, you know, an addict and an alcoholic and dealing with a lot of, you know, issues from you know, violence to bloody fear and abuse, you know.
So you're right, and if we pick up where the last book left off, you are heading out on the road with Cold Chisel. They're your family, mm-hmm. You know, you're living the dream. Were you still running, though, like your parents? You mentioned them running.
You know what? Yeah, I sort of was, but I just thought I was running away. I thought when I left, at the end of that first book and the start of this book, I'm in the back of the truck leaving Adelaide, right, with Cold Chisel for the first time we leave Adelaide, and I literally thought I was never going back. And I just thought, I can leave all this behind. And I tried never to think about my childhood again. And any time it ever sort of raised its head at all, I would squash it down, either by getting drunk or whatever. And over the period of the next 10 years, that got harder and harder to do. And because there was a lot of stuff from my childhood that I had to sort out. And, you know, I, by the way, I'm not blaming my childhood for my behavior as an adult. You know, I have to be responsible for my own behavior. There was a lot of stuff that I didn't deal with earlier on. You know, if I'd have been smart enough and you know, and had the opportunity, I would have dealt with, you know, I would have seen a therapist, you know, when I was, you know, 12 to deal with this stuff. But unfortunately, I never did it until I was, you know, 55. As these things came up, it got harder and harder to squash down because I didn't want to look at, you know, you don't want to look at things about your violence in your home or sexual abuse or stuff like that. So whenever anything came to me, I would squash it down by getting smashed. And that took more and more as the years went on and became more regular and to the point where I was just continually smashed for you know, most of my life.
My favorite part of this book is when you meet your wife, Jane, because it's the first time we really see you out of control on something that isn't an illegal substance. You seem blown away. You're blown away by love and the magic of Jane.
And I was, you know, trying desperately to be on my best behavior and not let her see what I was really like. You know, so I wanted her to like me so much. You know, I remember it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 29th of November, 1979. I walked into this room. It was a motel where there was a bunch of friends all sitting around, and I walked into a room and I looked across the room, and in the one corner was this girl sitting there like nobody had ever seen. She took my breath away. And it was so much so that I literally had to step out of the room and regather my thoughts, like, wow, what am I doing here? Did you see that, you know? This is me talking to myself, and I went back in, and I was just trying to catch her eye, trying to make her look at me, smile at me or something, and she didn't even notice me. I remember the moment. It was incredible.
You're very honest about you and Jane. What does she think of the books?
You know, listen, it's tough. It's been tougher living with all this stuff without dealing with it. The last few years, we've dealt with a lot of stuff in our lives. One of the things I talk about in the book too is, you know, we're in love and you know, we love each other, and being in love and loving, you know, people. It's not easy. It's not just like, it's not all like, you know, infatuation. It's not like that moment when I first seen her. To stay married and to stay as a couple and to go through all this together, we've had to work really hard, and she's helped me work through a lot of this stuff. It's been a roller coaster of a ride, and I think the fact that we were lucky that we did, you know, really love each other, and we managed to fight our way through all this stuff, because a lot of the stuff, you know, it nearly killed me, never mind us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact your marriage has survived all this is nothing short of a miracle. I mean, anyone can survive if you can.
Jane's a miraculous girl, you know?
Oh, yeah, I bet. Has it been a cathartic experience?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, From the time I started writing the first book, right through this process of the second book, you know, it's like, you know, I sit and write, and I'll spend a couple of hours sitting by myself writing, and I just feel like weights are being lifted off my shoulders. With the first book, I went out and I did that tour, and suddenly I'd go out and stuff that I hadn't spoken about ever, I was out in the public, I was on stage talking to thousands of strangers about, and the process of doing that made me, you know, come to, other realizations about my life and other, you know, thoughts that I had about situations in the book. So the whole process was really cathartic, and it kept growing, and it kept changing, and I kept learning more about myself, which led me, you know, basically to sort of writing the second one, because it was sort of to continue the process, looking back through my life and trying to sift through the good, the bad, and the ugly.
What do your kids make of it all?
You know, they were sad when they read both books. You know, they were sad when they read them. But you know, the second book, they've been with me through all this, and they've seen me, you know, like nearly spin off the rails, spin off the planet. You know, they've seen me struggling with life, and they've seen me fight my way through it and get on top of it. So they were sort of prepared for it, but probably I don't think they were prepared for the intensity and the harshness of it. You know, it was a tough life, and one of the things I'm really thankful for my parents for. You know, I don't say a lot about my parents in the second book, but one of the things I got from them was tough genes. I really hammered myself through the second book, you know, through my adult life. And the only thing that held me in there was, there was a few things. There was, you know, I was surrounded by good people. I was always like with the guys from Cold Chisel and Gadinsky from Mushroom Records and stuff. Good people surrounded me. And then I met my wife Jane, and sort of whenever it got really dark, she was like the shining light, the beacon to me. So I've been really lucky, but it's been a hectic ride.
Oh, absolutely. I was wondering about that. What saved you? Whether it was Jane or the music or a combination of both?
It was everything. It was, but you know, definitely it was. You know, this ultimately this book is a love story, because you know the thing that just kept me going, and I had the music and I was still drinking, killing myself. The thing that pulled me through all of this is the love of my children and the love of Jane. You know, really. I've always been a fighter. I'm tough, and I've always been a fighter. But there was times over the last, you know, 30 years where, you know, I thought things had got the better of me. I thought it had beaten me. But it was Jane and the kids that sort of kept me, you know, just gave me something to keep aiming for. No matter how low I got, once I picked myself up again, I'd charge at it with full enthusiasm, trying to get on top of things until it wore me down the next time. It's been a hell of a rollercoaster ride. I reckon it's sort of, I make jokes that there was incredible highs, because believe me, there was, metaphorically and literally, and some really despicable lows. I don't want to moan about it, because I did this, and the whole time I was going through this, I was living on the top of the world. I had everything I wanted. I was a rock singer in a band, touring the world, making lots of money. There's a lot of people who go through the same stuff as I have, and who have nothing, and don't have the support that I had. There's a lot of families, and there's a lot of men suffering out there, and because of them, there's a lot of families suffering out there. The stuff that I had to deal with as a child, it has marred and twisted and misshaped families all over Australia and New Zealand. Domestic violence is hurting people. Suicide rates are so high in males. It's just the violence to themselves and to their families is out of control. And I had the luxury of doing this, dealing with all this stuff in the context of being a rock and roll singer. So I had an outlet. My violence was on stage.
Yeah. You mentioned the money, and you talk a lot in the book about the music business being a business and the amount of debt you mm-hmm. racked up and how that felt like failure too. What's your view on possessions and things now, given back then it was, you bought everything you could get your hands on?
My whole life, I measured my own worth on what other people thought of me. And I did that since I was a child, because my parents, they just told us we had nothing, we were going to be useless, we're always going to have nothing. So I would try and make people like me, and at school I used to be, I tried to be top of the class so that if the teacher liked me, I was worth something. Then I became captain of the soccer team, and if I was captain and the team liked me, I was worth something. Then I was in gangs and I'd fight, and if I could fight better than the other guys, that meant I was worth something. Then I joined a band, and if the audience liked me, I was worth something. Then if I sold records, if I got a number one album, that means everybody liked me, I was worth something. Over the years, I've had to learn how to value my own self-worth based on my own integrity, as opposed to what other people project or think of me. Mm. And that took me a long time to do. And I think that's probably the most important lesson I've learned is, don't measure your self-worth through other people's eyes, because it's always distorted and everybody sees it different. If you want to really be, if you want to be, the person that you can look at in the mirror, you've got to do it on your own values and on your own terms. And, you've got to be able to stand there and say, hey, they might not like me, but I think I'm okay.
You first went to rehab in 2003 and again in 2011. How long have you been clean and sober now?
Last five years, I've sort of stopped getting hammered. I can still sit now and have sit down and watch TV at night with Jane, put my feet up and have a nip of whiskey and with water. I never ever in my life drank for pleasure. I drank to get smashed. I never took drugs just because I'll just have a little. I took everything I could get my hands on. I always did everything to stop thinking. And now I don't want to stop thinking. That's the difference. And that's probably started about 5 years ago, where I don't want to be destroyed. I don't want to destroy everything around me. I don't want to not feel. For me, it's the best thing in the world is sitting around and feeling, whether it's, emotional, whether it's pain, whether it's love, whether it's hope. As long as I'm feeling, I'm happy.
And you've learned to forgive yourself.
Yeah, I'm learning to forgive myself. Like most people, we always still, we all make mistakes, and I still make mistakes that I go, oh, shit, why did I do that? But yeah, I'm not making those mistakes that are going to cost me my life anymore, and that's a good thing.
Will you be taking this book on the road like the first one?
Yeah, I think we're going to come to New Zealand in May. But that's Working Class Man Stories and Songs. Sort of a continuation of that stage show I did with the Working Class Boy. Well, I'm in the process of writing it at the moment. But basically, the way I'll do it, I'll tell you stories, from the book, and sort of things that have already occurred to me since I finished writing the book, so I can expand on the stories And then I'll play songs, and the songs that I'll play aren't necessarily the I'm not going to go out and play K-San and all the hits. I'm going to be playing songs that are extensions of the story, songs that, you know, triggered stuff in my memory, songs that, you know, maybe songs that coaches all played when we were, you know, when I was 16, 17 years old, that formed the way the band sort of was, you know, became, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I'm in the process of putting that show together right now.
Brilliant. Look forward to it. Jimmy Barnes, absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Very nice to talk to you.
Don't you love that accent? Absolutely loved him. Now, those dates he mentioned are the tour with the book, and gosh, that'll be such a fun night. Tuesday, 8th of May in Christchurch. Thursday, the 10th of May in Wellington. Friday, the 11th at the Spark Arena in Auckland. And Saturday, the 12th of May in Hamilton. www.jimmybarnes, all one word, .co.nz if you want to get yourself some tickets. And as I say, extremely raw, extremely on it. Drugs and alcohol literally brought him to his knees. And he has rebuilt his life thanks to the love of his wife and family. So it's an extraordinary story. If you like Jimmy Barnes, you'll love it.